So today we're looking at Dhammapada verses 309 and 310, which read as follows. Chattari thanani naropamato apajjati para darupasevi apunyalabhang nikamaseyang Nindang tatiyang nirayang chatuthang apunyalabho gati cha papika bitasa bitaya rati cha thokika raja cha dandang garukang paneti Tasmanaro para darang naseve, which means four consequences a man who is negligent receives, who engages with the wife of another. The acquiring of impurity, a sleep that is disturbed, blame as the third, and hell as the fourth. Acquiring impurity and a final destination or a future destination that is bad. And for one who is fearful, with one who is fearful, the delight is but little. And the king imposes a severe punishment. Therefore, a man should not engage with the wife of another. So these verses were taught concerning a young man, the son of a very well-known Buddhist in the time of the Buddha. So in the time of the Buddha, there was a very rich man in the city of Sawati named Anathapindika. Anathapindika, the word itself means one who is a refuge, or one who gives alms to those who don't have a refuge, or to poor people. So he was a generous man, generous with his wealth, quite a special individual, a devout follower of the Buddha, a righteous and just individual. But he had a son. His son was named Kema. And his son Kema was exceptionally handsome, which is not a bad thing. But unfortunately, as a result of this, he found himself attractive to pretty much any woman of suitable age, including those who already had husbands. And taking advantage of this, he found himself inclined to break up the marriages of others, which at the time, I guess, was against the law. I don't think in most societies nowadays it is against the law. I don't really know the laws around it, but I don't think there's any legal ramifications. But in this time, it was a big deal. You could get in real trouble with the king if you broke up someone else's marriage. But he was undeterred and so engaged in extramarital intercourse and was caught and brought before the king. But the king of Sawati, was also a follower of the Buddha and had great esteem for Anathapindika, as did everyone. And so out of deference to Anat, to his appreciation of Anathapindika, he just let him go. And so came to realize that there were no consequences to his actions, and he kept on at it, not discriminating over the romantic relationships he pursued, and inclined towards breaking up the marriages of others. And got caught again and again, and each time the king didn't say anything to him, didn't even admonish him, just sent him on his way, until finally Anathapindika became aware of what was going on. Word came around to him. And quite disturbed, he brought him before the Buddha. And the Buddha taught these verses to Kema, which, according to the story, had a deep impact on the young man, and helped him to see, to appreciate that the consequences were not simply a potential punishment from a king. So, to get a lesson out of these verses, you either have to be an adulterer, or we have to generalize. And there are general, very valid general lessons that we can get from this. The one last aspect of the story that is included at the end as an addendum is that the answer to the question as to why was this young man so attractive to pretty much everyone. And according to the story, in ancient times, long, long in the past, in the time of a past Buddha, I guess after a past Buddha had come and gone, much like our time, he was a wrestler and a champion wrestler. And after winning the championship, he became a devout Buddhist and set up a banner or two banners on a very prominent golden jaitya or pagoda that was erected to the Buddha. So he just decorated this pagoda with banners. And the story says that as a result of that, he was greatly moved and joyful after having been able to do something so great, I guess because he had money and he was able to put something that was quite elaborate and expensive up in veneration of the Buddha who had passed away. And so at that moment, he summoned up the power of his goodness and said, "By the power of this good deed, may I become irresistible to all women who are not blood relatives of mine." And so he was. So the first lesson we can get from this story relates to this curious idea of being able to make this sort of determination, this wish, that is actually quite common in Buddhist circles and has devolved in modern times to this sort of petty and irresponsible use of power, the power of goodness and the power of determination, because they work together. The power of goodness is to strengthen the mind. When you perform good deeds of kindness, when you're ethical, the power that it gives the mind can be used, like any power, for good or for ill. You can use it for profound spiritual purposes, you can use it for superficial purposes. So I guess the general lesson is be careful what you wish for. And as Buddhists, we should be careful to appreciate why we are doing, why we do the things that we do, because the things that we do impact the inclination of our minds. And the second power is the power of our determinations, so the wishes that we make. They have power when your mind is powerful, because, of course, it's psychological. They affect your relationship with the world around you, so they can work to make you exceedingly handsome. Often people will wish for things like wealth and may very well become wealthy in the next life. Of course, it requires true goodness to gain this sort of strength of mind. You can't just be greedy and think, oh, I'll give this gift to someone, or I'll do this kindness, or I'll do this thing, not because it's good, but because I want something out of it. It's not, it kind of diminishes the good of it, you see. So the best, of course, determinations, and the sort of determinations that we should think about as Buddhists, are those that are in line with spirituality, in line with our practice, and they can be quite powerful. You'll see this during a meditation course. Often we will have meditators make determinations, and so the lesson here that's of interest to us mostly is what these determinations are for and how they can be powerful. The determinations that we'll make that within this hour or within this day, this sort of thing. Even a determination you might make at the end of your meditation practice, so you having sat for an hour or even a half an hour, even 15 minutes, making a determination that with the power of this goodness, may good things come from it. You can wish peace and happiness for others, for your parents, your loved ones. You can even wish for yourself. Say, through the power of this practice, may it support my pursuit of peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. May it support my practice, giving me the supportive conditions, even worldly conditions. There's nothing wrong for wishing for worldly conditions that are supportive of your meditation practice, for example. The second lesson that I think just briefly we can touch on is the power of addiction. It's an important reminder that our addictions are often too powerful for us individually. A principle of the Buddha's teaching is the need and the value of the association with others. Association with the teacher, even association with other meditators or other practitioners. How valuable that is in providing you with some new input. You know, being left to your own devices, it's very difficult to overcome these sorts of addictions. So the example here is of Kema, who was obviously very much addicted to this behavior that was terribly disruptive and problematic. You know, there's nothing innocent about breaking up someone else's marriage for your own selfish desires. And yet, addiction can be a very difficult thing that causes people to act in ways that are selfish, harmful, harmful to oneself, harmful to others, because we just can't help ourselves. So seeking out this sort of aid from others, or in this case, an intervention from his father. As meditators, or Buddhists, it's a reminder of the value of seeking out help, a reminder of not to take for granted the power, or not to trivialize the power of our defilements, and to appreciate that oftentimes we need more than just what we ourselves are capable of to help us pull ourselves out of them. Also to understand the danger of them, you know, that there are consequences, which this verse points out. The third thing that the verse reminds us of is the power of the Dhamma. So according to the story, he changed his whole life around by hearing the Dhamma, which we often hear is what happens when people go to listen to the Buddha. Obviously, that's a very profound experience that we all can feel envious of, not having the ability to hear the Dhamma from the Buddha himself. But even just hearing the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, having a connection with the Dhamma through our practice and through undertaking a meditation course, for example. a reminder that we should seek out the Dhamma, and that the Dhamma does have power. The Buddha's teaching, the practice of the Buddha's teaching, can do much more often than Buddhists think that it can do. Often you'll see in Buddhist societies or among those who have professed to be Buddhist, the idea that meditation is something that monks do or something that is for the purpose of calming the mind, not realizing that it has deeper, more profound potential, that it's able to help us overcome addiction, and it's able to wake us up. One example that you see not in Buddhist societies is the power of the five precepts, as an example. Often you hear expressed by foreigners who have never heard of Buddhism before, who come to Buddhism for the first time, how if only someone had explained to them the five precepts, then perhaps they might have kept them, and how we can go through our lives never even thinking on any deep level that things like killing or stealing or cheating, adultery, lying, drugs or alcohol, never thinking these are bad because we're taught that these are good. So another aspect of this is a reminder of the importance of us to share the Dhamma with others, not just keep it to ourselves, because it can mean the difference between heaven and hell. It can mean the difference between freedom and enslavement to desires and to addictions, just to hear about the Dhamma. For the verse itself, the verse is an example of this. The first verse is an example giving us four reasons not to do things like engage with other people's marital partners. And so the four are, first of all, acquiring impurity. So punya in Buddhism means something, literally something like purity or cleansing of the mind. But it's used to mean goodness. So the word punya is just a general word. Anytime you do something good, when you're kind to others, generous, when you keep ethics, well, this is a kind of punya. When you practice meditation, this is a kind of punya. Even when you appreciate other people's good qualities, this is a kind of punya. Because punya, goodness, is something that is mental. It's something that you engage in mentally. Even when you express appreciation for someone else, this cleanses the mind. And that's why it's called punya. Now, apunya is, of course, the opposite. Apunya is the corruption of the mind. And so the first problem with evil is that it corrupts your mind. The first problem with things like engaging with someone else's spouse is that it sullies your mind, gives you the greed and anger and delusion that makes you unattractive. Not to those who would seek out romantic partners, but unattractive to wise people, unattractive to good people. It changes your associations, the people who are interested in associating with you. It makes it more difficult. The acquiring of polluted, of mental corruption makes it more difficult to practice things like meditation, makes it more difficult to see clearly, makes it more difficult to make good decisions in your life. Your mind is clouded, and so you choose based on partiality, based on addiction, based on aversion. Very difficult to improve your spiritual well-being. Something we don't realize often before practicing the Buddhist teaching is how every deed has consequences, and the true deep meaning of karma is how it affects our minds, how it pollutes the mind. We're not static individuals that can engage as we like in good or evil. Good changes us, but evil also changes us. The second is nikamaseya, which means sleep that is disturbed or uncomfortable. And not just sleep, but our dwelling, our life. It disrupts our life, but most extremely seen in the disruption to our sleep. Our inability to sleep peacefully, our inability to be at peace mentally, I mean, it expresses itself very much in our violent dreams or our inability to sleep, tossing and turning, lusting after the objects of our desire, or worried or afraid of retribution for our evil deeds, deluded in our doubt and uncertainty, our worries and so on. All of these things, the Buddha said, in one discourse the Buddha pointed out, well, this is what is different. This is what is the problem for one who has greed, one who has anger, one who has delusion, that they don't sleep at ease. You can see it quite clearly in how disturbed they are, no matter how confident they are of their chasing after the objects of their desire. At night, that sort of lust consumes them. It makes it very difficult to be at peace. The third is ninda. Ninda means blame or having people having a bad reputation, disparagement. Obviously, someone who engages habitually in evil deeds is going to be the subject of great disparagement, something that no one in the world likes. No, nobody wants to be the subject of disparagement, other people gossiping about you, saying bad things about you. No one wants this. It's one of the worldly dhammas that everyone wishes to avoid. And it is bad. It's objectively unpleasant, harmful, makes it difficult to build friendships, and makes it difficult to associate with good people when they hear bad things about you. It can be a real detriment on your spiritual practice as well, as other spiritual individuals are disinclined to associate with you. And the fourth is the topic of this whole chapter. And you might have noticed a theme that we're in the hell chapter. This is the chapter where every verse somehow relates to the idea of hell. So the Buddha said, Nirayang Chatutang, and the fourth problem with engaging with the partner of another, breaking up their marriage, is hell. Because it's a corruption, it's a terrible thing that you're doing to disrupt someone else's life, you know, in that way, to help someone break their vows, to break their trust with another. But of course, we're not really interested specifically in this deed, but in evil deeds in general. Hell is the sort of thing you can look forward to if you're evil enough, and habitual enough in your evil. Then when you die at the moment of death, there is great corruption in the mind, great fear, great anger, great attachment, and all of these things pollute the mind and incite you to grab on to something of the same nature when you die. And at the moment of death, grabbing onto something unpleasant, grabbing onto something out of fear or anger or delusion or so on, will only lead to a rebirth of suffering. So these sorts of things, again, it's the kind of thing that can be valuable to hear about, a reminder of how valuable it is to talk about such things and to really have an honest perspective on the consequences of our actions. I mean, conversely, we can feel quite comforted and happy, encouraged through the practice of the Dhamma, our practice of kindness and generosity, our practice of ethics. Even just in a meditation course, the level of ethics that you have is so sublime. Not even to speak about the level of mental development that comes through the practice of mindfulness, the purity in every moment of noting the foot moving, the purity of watching your experiences, noting the stomach rising and falling, noting pain, cleansing the mind of the hate and the anger and the aversion to pain, the attachment to pleasure and calm, the worry and fear and anxiety about thoughts, about the past and the future, the facing of all the hindrances of liking and disliking and so on. All of these things can be taught as their opposites. There are consequences to doing good deeds. The consequences are just the opposites. But either way, hearing about the Dhamma and learning the Dhamma is a very important thing. And so this verse is just a great reminder of the good and the bad, the consequences of the bad. The second verse, one thing that the second verse says of interest, though, is I think gives this a sort of a deeper meaning. So we can notice from these verses that the Buddha didn't just teach the deepest of the teachings, the ultimate level of ethics and morality, because what's missing here is the fact that any kind of romantic involvement still involves desire and addiction. And putting aside romantic involvement, any kind of, at an ultimate level, any kind of liking of any sensual experience is a cause for addiction. And so on the most subtle level, as Buddhist meditators, we can see that you don't have to do something so glaringly unwholesome as engaging with another person's partner to cultivate addiction. Addiction comes in every moment. You can be addicted to the calm feelings of meditation. When you practice meditation and feel calm, you like the calm feeling. And then the next time you practice, you look for it. You seek it out. You try to arrange your practice or cultivate your practice in such a way as to gain those feelings again. When you don't get them, you're disappointed. When they disappear, you're also disappointed. When someone tells you to face them and note them and note the liking and that liking is a problem, you're also uncomfortable and displeased by that. But the first point I want to make is that the Buddha didn't always teach this. And we don't have to think as Buddhists that we're terrible, evil, bad Buddhists just because we engage in some sensual desire, sensual pleasure. I mean, even monks are not bad monks because they enjoy the taste of the food that they eat. They can be criticized. We can all can be criticized, but the point is not to be too critical. The Buddha never expected lay people to be celibate, for example. He never expected even monks to not enjoy the food that they eat. He expected us to practice and to face these things and to learn about them. So this verse is a reminder that the Buddha did have levels at which he taught, and different ways of teaching these various levels. So things like adultery are wrong, and no Buddhist should ever engage in them. There's no excuse, there's no tolerance for it. Someone who does it is not following the Buddha's teaching, is not likely to be reborn as a human being, is really on a bad path, and has really just not listened to anything the Buddha has said. But someone who engages, a lay person who engages in sexual activity, romantic activity, is not a bad Buddhist. They're limited in their practice of the Buddha's teaching, and that's understandable. So there's an acknowledgement that ultimately an enlightened being gives that up as well, and gives up the enjoyment of food. Monks are to acknowledge that their liking of delicious food is a problem. And it's based on addiction, and part of their practice is to face that, learn about it, and to see that true happiness and true peace is inhibited by the stress that comes from their desire and their attachment, their addiction to certain types of food, and thus their aversion to other types of food, and so on and so on. But there are levels. But the other thing that the second verse says about this sort of terrible, terrible evil that's mentioned in these verses, in the story, is that you can point to how little pleasure and enjoyment comes from such terrible evil deeds. because you engage in them out of the attachment to the pleasure that comes from it. But the Buddha says, bitasa bitaya ratija tokika. Bita is one who is afraid. So the one person who is afraid with the other person who is afraid, when you're together with someone who is afraid, the fear really puts a damper on the enjoyment. And so the lesson he's giving is that ordinary types of sensual addiction, like addiction to food, yes, they may be problematic, but they're free from this sort of dreadful fear of retribution that comes from theft or murder or cheating, lying. How much stress and suffering comes from lying and having to remember the lies that you've told and having to keep up the lies and keep people away from the truth. When you lie to those you love, those who love you, those who are close to you. The point is that it's just not worth it. But as meditators, we can apply this lesson to our practice as well and notice that really that's on some level true of all attachment and all addiction. There's a saying I read that it's like sugar cane. The practice of the Dhamma is like eating sugar cane from the top down. The top of a sugar cane is not very sweet, but as you go further down, it gets sweeter and sweeter. So the practice of the Dhamma, the practice of spirituality, becomes sweeter as you cleanse the mind and purify the mind, and as it becomes more familiar and comfortable to you. The purity becomes a reward in itself, bringing with it peace and comfort and general ease in the world. Whereas sensual pleasure is like eating sugar cane from the bottom up. In the beginning, it's very sweet. But the way addiction works is that your brain needs more and more of the addictive chemicals, more and more to be pleased to the same extent. So the more you engage in it, the more you need to engage in it to be just even baseline happy. And so one thing we see through the practice of mindfulness is that the pleasure that comes from engaging in sensuality is momentary, toka, the Buddha, tokika, which means very little. There are only moments of pleasure. When you're eating delicious food, you think, wow, that was such a great meal, I enjoyed it so much. But be mindful during that time and you'll notice, oh, actually, it's not really as enjoyable as I thought. There are moments of enjoyment for sure, but there are also moments of displeasure as you eat and eat and the food becomes mush in your mouth. If you were to keep it any more in your mouth, it would be revolting. And then you swallow it and you have to seek out more and more and more. And then you eat too much because of your greed, because of your desire, and then you have the stomach ache and so on. You start to notice more granularly, on a more granular level, moment by moment, that the happiness that comes from it is only very little, the pleasure that comes from it. And there's so much more that is displeasing and uncomfortable. And at the end, once it's finished, all you're left with is the desire for more. That isn't ever satiated. It comes back with a vengeance, and then you need more and more and more. And you become, it moves from wanting something to needing it, such that when you don't get it, you're disappointed and uncomfortable. So some things for us to remember. First of all, remember determination and the power of determination. That you can make determinations in your meditation, resolve for what you look to get out of your practice of the Buddha's teaching. Having a strong direction that you're headed. What is this for? Not just for something trivial like being beautiful or handsome, but for something deeper that is truly going to bring a deeper sense of happiness and peace. Remember addiction and the power of it and the importance of seeking help. Remember the power of the Dhamma, that this help is available through learning about the Dhamma, listening to the Dhamma, sharing the Dhamma with others to give benefit to them. bringing other people close to you to the Dhamma, dragging your children when they misbehave to teach them the reasons why they shouldn't do evil deeds. But also on a deeper level to remember the nature of addiction, that it's just not worth it, and that the pleasure is far outweighed by the displeasure from not getting what you want and from being blamed for it, and the potential to be born in an unpleasant destination as a result of our constantly seeking out things that can't possibly satisfy us. So, a simple lesson, but has much for us to contemplate and reflect upon. That's the Dhammapada for today. Thank you for listening.